Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I have Brooke Bowman in. She's one of the creators of Vibe Camp, and she is the first guest, our guinea pig, our mutual in a series that we're calling Get to Know a Mutual. So the origins of this series are kind of came about during COVID. During COVID, the show has experienced a huge expansion in our audience. And the audience itself has been very loving, very great, and we get a lot of positive comments. But within these positive comments, there's this thread of kind of people saying, like, you need to do a positive show. You need to do a fun show. Like, these 2 hours ex of, you know, examining white supremacy or terrorism or extremism, they're informative, they're great, they're enlightening, but oh my fucking God, they're depressing. Could you do a fun show? So I kind of struggle with being a fun person. I think anybody who follows me on Twitter knows that I am kind of a my main job is malware analyst. My hobby is studying extremism. So there's not a lot of chill there. So what I kind of wanted to do is I follow a lot of smart people, a lot of cool people, a lot of people who are doing really neat projects. And kind of the purpose of this series is to step out of that examination of extremism and to get to know a mutual, somebody who's really doing something really cool. And I thought the perfect first guest is Brooke. She is one of the creators of Vibe Camp and kind of a, I think, a driving force in kind of bringing a physical community to an on to the online space, right? You know, as people, we are still physical, despite, you know, a lot of our socialization happening online. And I thought Vibe Camp is this great idea, is this great sort of not institution, but great sort of community. And I wanted to highlight that, and I wanted to be in discussion with Brooke, who has this really cool life story in addition to creating Vibe Camp, being one of the creators of Vibe Camp. So with all that being said, please welcome Brooke. How's it going?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. That was a wonderful introduction. I'm so flattered to be your guinea pig.
Oh, thank you so much for being the guinea pig. I know that I think there was a lot of conversation on Twitter about kind of you know, our usual listeners, or you know, they tune into the show and it's like extremism, and then now we're kind of doing a more fun show. With that being said, one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is that I kind of find your personal journey really fascinating, and kind of your personal journey from that beginning to the creation of Vibe Camp. So, in essence, this is kind of like a tell us the origin of Vibe Camp and how it came to be, and kind of how it relates to your own journey.
Sure. That's I can go into varying degrees of detail here, but I'll start with kind of like a more brief summary. I spent a decade as a heroin addict. I graduated to crystal meth and right around the time I got on the streets. I was homeless in Los Angeles for roughly 2 years and experienced a lot of things that kind of fundamentally changed who I am as a person. And those things were how I got off, how I became the person I am now. The difference between the person that I was throughout the rest of my life and the person that I am now is night and day. I never used to describe myself as a happy person. I'm a big fan of like being truthful, being authentic and honest, and that was never a truthful answer. And fairly consistently since I got off the street, which was and got sober, which was early 2020, I have been describing myself and believing myself to be a very happy person. And so there were a number of things that had to change in my brain. Some of these things were becoming aware of kind of who I was and what I wanted and how I had not been really being honest with myself about that most of my life. I had a lot of anxiety. I think that's the main reason I had so much difficulty dropping heroin, up until the point I was ready to. I think that I had just been deeply anxious nearly all the time. Even my like body temperature has changed. I used to be like a very like just my hands were cold all the time, my extremities were cold, everybody commented on it. And now I'm just like warm all the time. I don't have all this tension, this anxiety bringing all the blood to like the center of my body. And but some of those changes were having to do with my own agency as a human being. I had to let go of a few different things that I can go into more detail later if you'd like. But I really started to learn how to have the things that I want, how to do the things that I want, instead of looking at something and saying, "Oh, that thing looks good," and then just like walking on and not doing it, or "That thing is bad," and then not doing anything about it. Now I am much better. It's much easier for me to just be like, "Oh, that's a good thing. I'm gonna find a way to make that happen in my life." And when I got off the streets, I had been estranged from my parents, and called to have them rescue me from a domestic violence situation. I had a cat and a backpack, and through the course of that, after I fled, the ex of mine hacked into my Google account trying to track me. We fought over control. I got locked out of it, lost all my passwords. I think I changed phone numbers too many times. I don't remember exactly, but I could not get back into it. So basically, I came back to Reading, to my childhood home, with nothing. No digital footprint, and I hadn't really been online in many years because I'd had so much shame over the person that I was. I didn't want to share it with anybody. So I had very, very little in the way of physical objects, very little in the way of like a digital footprint. So I had the opportunity to just figure out who I was and build that person from scratch, kind of. It kind of was a process of scaling up a little bit in all right, like I'm gonna work on these things, and then once I've accomplished those things, I feel like I can automate them, kind of. I'm gonna like try and like push them a little bit farther or find new things to work on. So at first it was reaching out to my old friends. I had difficulty reconnecting with them because I had changed so much, and not all of them had, and I had difficulty just kind of even explaining, the transformation that I'd undergone. Found my way to Twitter through an old IRL connection, and just immediately started feeling like I had found a tribe finally. And started trying to meet people from Twitter, started doing one-on-one hangouts. I would travel for things. I would start hosting bigger things, and just the momentum I was seeing with that, and with other people doing meetups, I kind of saw that a large gathering would happen at some point. I like to joke that the reason why I decided to do it because I knew that I wouldn't be able to afford to go otherwise. And if I'm organizing, I kind of have to be there. But I saw in June or July of 2021, Grounded Sage tweeted, "When is the first in-group meetup with attendance in the thousands?" And so I quote tweeted that, and I was like, "You guys actually want this to happen? Because if you do, I will make sure it happens. But if nobody cares, then I'm not going to put in the work." And people were very excited about it, and I pulled together a team. We started having weekly meetings. There have been some changes to that team over time, but we pretty rapidly pulled it together. I think we had a place booked in November. The event happened in March, and it was successful beyond any of our expectations. That roughly answered your question.
No, that's really awesome. Something that that fascinated me while I was kind of doing research, I'm just going to put that in quotes, research, was kind of this relationship of kind of being homeless, unhoused, and that journey to regain your agency. And I find that really fascinating because that's a really like big thread in a lot of extremist stories. Like you have a lot of stories where people kind of give up their agency, never regain it, do something really illegal, and go to jail or get killed. But you kind of were able to regain it. What was kind of that process? Like what were the steps? Like what did you Was it just like one day you just wake up and you said, fuck it, I need to sort of, move in the direction of me and become, establish myself? Or what is that process? What were kind of the hiccups and kind of the fits and the kind of forwards, so to speak?
This is not going to be exhaustive because these are very, very complex things that happened, and I'm not even sure I have a clear idea in my head of exactly what went into that. I would say one of the sort of like lesser elements was dumpster diving. Oddly enough, I was having difficulty figuring out how to survive. For a while, I attached myself to a guy. I was at a very bad place and I needed protection. It is very dangerous, and so that was how I survived for a little bit. But he was a very good dumpster diver. It was one of the more well-known dumpster divers in Los Angeles, because that is apparently a thing. And it's really astonishing what people throw away. I won't even go into that, but it's really, I kind of love dumpster diving. It's like a treasure hunt. But you'd have to be creative. You'd have to kind of like find new ways to fix things. I got a little bit into like splicing cables and things like that to make things work, or fixing random objects because you don't have money to repair them or buy new ones. And I would set myself little tasks, like just like little creativity things, like, all right, I'm gonna make a snack today from the food that I find in this dumpster. And that had other effects, like my taste changed really drastically over the course of that too. And I don't think that's really a common thing for adulthood. So that was kind of like one of the lessons related, just like the sheer creativity that comes from like living under such restrictions. But I think one of the really major ones was through that, the domestic violence thing that happened. It was a really like very particular sequence of events that happened there, which really increased the amount of empathy that I have for people in those situations. I had very little up to that point. I kind of saw it as like, you get hit once, it's not your fault, but then you stay and get hit again. Like, I don't really have any pity for you or sympathy. And I didn't really understand how people could do that or why. And I ended up, it's funny, they almost like follow a playbook, and that they haven't read anything about it, but it ticked all the boxes. But it didn't start out that way. And a separate track, sidetrack of this is probably worth mentioning, is that I had gotten to a point where I realized I had made bad decisions in my life, but I had no idea what they were. I was willing to question my most deeply held beliefs and intuitions on things. Because I had no idea which one was wrong, so it could have been any of them. I met this guy who was very sharply dressed, very handsome, young. He was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years younger than me. He was working, and I was dumpster diving, and I was that was at a time when I was about as close to rock bottom as I think a person can get in life. I won't go into details on that at the moment, but it was a rough time. And I met him, and he worked long hours. And he was a student. He was an immigrant from Iran, and he seemed to have his life together in all the ways that I did not. He was also a really unpleasant person. He was rude. He was bigoted. He would get just in these rages at customer. He worked for DoorDash, and at the time, I was like, well, you know what? I've been believing this whole time that who you are on the inside is what's most important, your values, your principles. Maybe I have been wrong. Maybe I should be seeking these external like indicators of success. Maybe that's the thing I've gotten wrong my whole life. So I tried a thing with him, and very early on in that, there was a night when he was telling me a story. And this is going to contain some of what became many, many red flags that I like looked at and then did nothing about. There had been this girl that he had this obsession over in very long distance. So he did not really talk to her much, just kind of like watched her and obsessed over her. And he sent her a text message sharing his feelings, and she either didn't respond or was flippant about it. And he got really drunk. His friends all kept being like, it's fine, it's just a crush, he'll get over it, don't worry about it. He was so depressing, they ditched him, I think. And he smoked 2 packs of cigarettes and woke up in the hospital after having a heart attack on the street at like 21. And which should have been a big red flag. But at the time, I was like, oh, like I had one of those unrequited crushes in high school. Mine wasn't nearly so obsessive. I found out later he also put a tracking device on her car, which is a whole other level. But at the time, I was like, yeah, like, okay, so this is something that I have worked through. I have something of value I can offer to this person. He needs me more than I need him. And I kind of told myself, like, I still had a lot of active trauma that I hadn't processed yet. And I told myself, I'm going to process that, just not right now. Right now, this person needs me. I need to stop being immature. I need to be there for him. And so I mean, it's almost like, see, it's like a special interest kind of thing. I like immediately just poured every bit of energy I like thought I had into trying to forge myself into the kind of person that I thought he needed. I practically overnight, I stopped using. I got a couple jobs. I became very chipper. I would talk about him about talk with him about everything. You know, when he started to get like angrier towards me, and when it started to get physical and things like that, we would have these really like intensive conversations about it. I would try not to lead him to the answers. It was this whole thing. And then I got to a point where I just realized, like, I mean, after every fight, I would think about what had happened, what I could try differently next time. Then the next time I'd try something a little different and a little different, and it's just all I thought about. And after a couple months, I just realized I had nothing left to try. I was done. And I did not know anything about domestic violence at the time. I did not realize how dangerous it is to tell people that you were leaving. He would get upset when I told him I need to go for a walk to calm down. He would follow me. He'd try and like throw me into his car and things like that. And this time I told him I was leaving. I was not coming back. I was not going for a walk. And he almost killed me. He smothered me over the course of like 3 or 4 hours in his car. And I spent the next like day and a half kind of in like a zombie mode. Finally got myself out of there when I was like looking up domestic violence, and I think I read a statistic somewhere that said if you are the victim of a blocked airway attack, you're by an intimate partner, you are 700% more likely to die at their hands than other kinds of violence. And that was kind of eye-opening. I didn't think he was going to kill me, but probably all 700% of those people thought that too. So I left, and then in the course of processing that, I realized I had changed myself so drastically in such a short period of time. And if I could do that for him, I could do that for me. And that was really the key moment, like internalizing that it is possible to change like quite a bit, very, very rapidly, just by deciding to. It's kind of simple and obvious, but it wasn't a thing that I had quite grokked to that degree until that happened. And then I started doing it.
Interesting. So then 2020 comes around, and this is kind of the beginning of Vibe Camp, or the sort of the starting point. Can you kind of walk us through, like, what was that kind of initial, like, from seed to like tree, so to speak? Like, what was that process like? Was it just like, what was that brainstorming, and kind of, how did you meet your partners? And then kind of, what were the sort of planning sessions like in development of Vibe Camp?
So I joined Twitter in July of 2020, and it was almost exactly a year after that the Genesis tweet, the Grande Sage tweeted and that I co-tweeted came about. So this was late summer of 2021, and under my quote tweet, I was like, "Who wants to do this with me?" And I had a number of people just like comment on that. I had other people tag someone in. I think that's how Grin underscore IO is on the team. I think he somebody else tagged him because he had been talking about something similar. And I just had an intuition that we would lose momentum if we didn't meet regularly. So we've been meeting every Sunday evening since then. We started out with a much different vision for Vibe Camp. The crew of people that were working on it was slightly different. We had been kind of turning around a more Burning Man style event. And actually, when I first tweeted about it, I had been thinking a conference because so many of my friends are working on cool things. I thought it would be really awesome to like have booths that have people show off their projects and things like that. But I tweeted about it, and Twitter very resoundingly came back with the answer that they wanted to vibe in the woods. And that's where the name came from too. My choice for name was TikTokCon. That was pre-rat suggestion. Because at the time we were calling like whatever Twitter scenes TikTok, like this quarter of Twitter. And I thought that was a clever play on words. But there have been a few times where Twitter, I've put things up to vote and Twitter has outvoted me. And they made the right call. Vibe Camp's a very catchy name. I don't imagine it would have done as well as it did without it. But so originally we were thinking very Burning Man, very just like, tent camping, whatever, people provide their own food, people provide all the stuff, everything. And we were having trouble finding a location. So during the months of like August, September, I think that was just a lot of just kind of brainstorming, tweeting about things, talking in the meetings. We set up a Twitter account somewhere around there, and we started a Discord server that had almost no one in it for months. And I think that time was pretty important because it allowed us to kind of like think forward and imagine what kind of things we would need to have in place once things got rolling. So it helped to have that infrastructure that was kind of built as we had these meetings before we had a site booked. And I think the site we got booked in November, and things just took off after that. Then it was kind of process, figuring out like what's the least steps we can take to get this done. What's the lowest overhead way to do ticketing? What's the yeah, I think, sorry, I lost my train of thought there. But I think we started ticket sales in December, maybe. Cut them off a month and a half before the event, so very, very early 2022. And we had a problem with PayPal. They shut down our account twice, so we moved to Stripe right at the end of ticket sales. And we were planning to cut a cap at 250 people. And because we got such a rush of people, we were sending out links individually through DMs and like picking up confirmation screenshots through DMs. It was just a wild, wild day that we ended up, our attendee number shot up to like a little over 400 in like a from low 200s, mid 200s in the course of like a day and a half. That was unexpected, but turned out great.
That's awesome. So I think like for me, one of the big reasons why I wanted to get you on the show is because you've built this community in a short amount of time. And I think for me, doing the Loopcast for like almost a decade now, I think that's kind of has always been the big struggle for me, is like building a cohesive community of interest. So I'm kind of curious, like when you after all the kind of process of setting up VibeCamp was done, like what were the kind of what was your thinking in going, in constructing a community? Was it just like, I'm going to take what's on Twitter and then we're going to make it real? Or is it was it kind of more complex? Like, for you, like what were the most important parts of building a community? How did you go about it, so to speak?
I kind of realized we were building community after we'd already started building community. VibeCamp as an idea has evolved quite a bit over time. Initially, I just wanted to meet my mutuals. There were a bunch of people who were an anonymous, pseudonymous, and it had gotten to a point where there are so many of them. I wanted to meet all of them. It's too expensive to travel all the time. And I thought, well, if you plant a flag, maybe a bunch of them will come and I can meet them. It wasn't until we reached the numbers that we did, and then also watched kind of the aftermath on Twitter and in a bunch of cities around the country, and some in some cases the world. There were it's been really phenomenal and kind of Josh, I don't even know. It's shocking. It's amazing. It's incredible watching the various gatherings that have happened in the wake of VibeCamp. Things like Kai Camp and Jess Camp happened before Vibe Camp, but I think she did say that it was kind of like looking at the idea of Vibe Camp that inspired her to do it. And I've heard from people in cities across the US that after Vibe Camp, they all of a sudden had like a thriving social scene in their cities that hadn't existed before. But we went into it just we want to meet our friends. And then it turned out we had a lot of friends. And all of our friends had friends, and then they told their friend, and it just kind of like it just really, really grew. And I kind of wonder if part of it isn't that we don't really have a clear identity. We're very illegible. We don't have any particular ideology. We don't have anything really like that. It's really more about who you are as a human and kind of like how you view the world, although I'm a little hesitant to say that. And I think that goes a long way because there's so many people who get excluded or who don't feel a resonance with one particular thing. And maybe that particular thing is like a subset of whatever happens at Vibe Camp. But because there are all these other things that are kind of like component parts. I think that's kind of part of what helped the sort of like nascent VibeCamp community get as large as it has.
How much of that is Twitter, and how much of that, like, I'm kind of curious about like the interplay of community building and Twitter, because in my personal experience of like building the Loopcast as kind of a conversation thing, Twitter has been amazing. Like, it's, I don't know what it is. I can't even describe it, but it's just like maybe entropy, maybe randomness, but like just finding mutuals and finding people on Twitter has been really cool. And I'm kind of curious, like, what was the role that Twitter played in building this community? Was it only Twitter, or did you kind of conceptualize it as Twitter in the center, and then you kind of expand out? You go from Twitter to Discord to whatever else.
It was almost only Twitter. It definitely started out being only Twitter, and we used Discord because we needed a way to be able to like brainstorm a little bit more directly about project ideas and the organization and meetups, things like that. I think that what I want to say what maybe happened is that like the Twitter algorithm groups people based on their interests, except we're not really part of like any clear like interest. We're not part of like academia. We're not part of like econ Twitter. There's so many different types of Twitter bubbles. And I think what makes our bubble a bubble is just that we're all kind of friends with each other. So then we've got all these people who are friends with each other, and then all of their friends, and a lot of them are EAs, a lot of them are rationalists. So we had a lot of people, the people that we had who were not Twitter people and were not somebody's spouse or significant other, were largely pulled from those communities in various cities. Rationalists on Twitter would tell their rationalist friends in their city about it, and so we had people gathering that way. But it was definitely started out as just a Twitter thing. And I think we were all kind of a little bit surprised at how wide the interest has grown in it beyond the scope of Twitter.
That's so awesome. Like, I just, for all the faults of Twitter, for all the kind of awfulness, it's, I think there's less emphasis on kind of its positive elements. And I think, like, you kind of hit on it really well, like this networked effect of you start with 10 people, and then 10 people tell 10 other people, and then it just keeps growing, and then suddenly you have like 500 people showing at your doorstep or something. I just like the interplay of like being able to relate the online to IRL. And it's just, I think I'm most convinced that Twitter is the best at that. I don't think any other platform kind of succeeds at linking those two elements.
Yeah, with Twitter, you kind of like have you have longevity, and it gives you social proof. And there is misleading social proof. People get social proof through having a lot of followers. It doesn't necessarily mean they are a good or trustworthy person. But I kind of like came onto Twitter like super high energy. Like I was kind of like an unbelievable person. I had a few people tell me like, yeah, I didn't think you're real. Like not that I was a fake person, but just that I was presenting, sort of like a false persona. But enough time goes by, and if people are unstable, you're gonna see evidence of meltdowns and things like that. And if you don't, that really offers a lot in the way of social proof. And then every time you have a meetup and you tweet about it, that kind of like adds to the level of like, okay, like this person is safe to hang out with. It seems like people are having fun around them. Like maybe this is an okay thing to go to. So I think that's one of the ways that Twitter helps with that a lot.
It does. Like, I think one of my favorite, well, not favorite, but like one of the trolls that I like to do is have somebody identify as me to go to a meetup, so nobody knows. So it creates this like Kaiser Sose sort of element. Which kind of brings me to this idea of like when you're building a community, how do you deal with trolls? Like, is it, do you reject them? Do you embrace them? Like, because I know like Twitter is just fantastic for building community, but at the same time, it's also kind of legendary for, being a venue for trolls and kind of being a venue for people who kind of thrive on aggravation. But you know, how do you embrace the trolls? Do you, you know, isolate them? What is that sort of dynamic?
So there's a difference between being a troll and being a bad actor or being somebody who's going to make a situation unsafe or unpleasant for other people. I think that given my history, it is much easier for me possibly than the average person to kind of hang out in various kinds of social circles. Like I'm just as comfortable talking to homeless people as I am to talking to VCs. And that applies. I mean, I feel like I'm one of a number of people who kind of hangs out in Schizo Twitter or hangs out in Tech Twitter or Earnest Twitter and kind of has friends in all those spaces. So I definitely don't begrudge my troll friends. I think that all of us on the VibeCamp team have a little bit of trollishness in us. An example being we just had this huge announcement for public ticket sales, and it are the link that was there for the survey that people that allowed people to get on the first come first serve list had been up on our website for weeks prior to the announcement in our if anybody bothered to read the FAQ and things like that. I mean, it feels a little bit trollish, but as far as actual trolls go, we've been remarkably lucky, and maybe it's not luck. I think that we have done a good job, even if it wasn't intentionally, of just bringing together people who are largely really, really kind and really wonderful people. Part of that might be that you're not going to want to be friends with me or watch my feed if you're a really mean person or kind of jaded because I'm just so bubbly. It's probably really off-putting for people like that. So that might be a little bit of gatekeeping there. And also just you have to kind of really, really be excited about VibeCamp to want to come to VibeCamp. There were a few people that came because they wanted to watch the disaster happen. Those were fun to talk to afterwards. I had a few people come up and apologized. I hadn't even known that was why they were there. And they're like, yeah, you guys did a great job. But it's called VibeCamp. It was at a children's summer camp. It was full of a bunch of nerds. I mean, the kind of person who cares about status and how they're being looked. I mean, those people are gonna try to avoid VibeCamp, I think. We are just cringe enough to be off-putting for the kinds of people who are probably more likely to be unpleasant to be around.
That's awesome. I just like it just like that's such a cool kind of anti-negative troll technique. It's just that you're just so positive and so cringe that you just don't know what to do with you. It's just like I don't I find like with the Loopcast, it's kind of that. It's kind of like being really positive and really cringe, but also like super dark and super depressing. Like people like the only people who want to engage are the ones who are into it. Because like we've been doing the Loopcast for 10 years and I have never, I mean, knock on wood, I, you know, as soon as I say it, it's gonna happen. But we haven't had any like real negative trolls ever. Which is, it just kind of blows my mind. And I think now that I've stated it in public, that's going to turn around and bite me in the ass. Anyway.
It's amazing though.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think with the online, it's just like so hard to do anything without like not moderation, but kind of being aware that there is going to be like bad, they're potentially going to be like bad actors or people who want to, you know, kind of revel in your destruction as opposed to, you know, reveling in your construction and kind of building stuff up. I guess you have to kind of take both with the online. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just I've been very much enjoying lately. We've got a little bot that tweets vibe or posts VibeCamp tweets in the Discord server. And every once in a while, someone will be really grumpy about VibeCamp, and I'll go to look at it and it'll get one like or maybe two. Like it's I don't know how this happened, but it is very uncool to make fun of VibeCamp, and it's kind of I kind of feel bad for the people trying to do it to see they never get any engagement.
That's awesome. So when I was reading through the value statement of VibeCamp on the website, which everybody can go read it, something that I kind of really liked is kind of this idea of diversity and illegibility, mostly because like me coming from a corporate environment, when I hear the word diversity, it ends up being the cringiest thing ever. But yet, like reading through the VibeCamp, the value statement, it actually made a lot of sense to me, and it was kind of cool. And so I want you to kind of explore for us, the importance of diversity and its kind of relationship to illegibility. That is a broad philosophical question. I apologize.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think that they are related, at least in this context. I was talking a little bit about that with some people this morning. There is no real solid ideology behind this like collection of communities. There's like a VibeCamp community, and then there's this broader Twitter and IRL community. They're all like a whole bunch of communities that have all kind of like started to glom together a little bit and have their own little spaces. And for most of I can't think of any real ideological thing that ties people together. A lot of people like joke about steering away from object level takes on Twitter. I kind of feel like, and this isn't applied to everybody, this might be less applicable like tech schizo Twitter, as for instance, than it is to like earnest Twitter. But I feel like one of the core values that is often reflected among the people that I interact with the most is curiosity, and possibly to a lesser extent kindness, just because there are some like snarky people out there. Just quick side note, the snarky people, I have hung out with some of them and like in like group chats, and I whenever somebody in that group chat actually needs help, they all like just really come together. I've seen it happen a few times, and so I maybe kindness still does apply, even if it doesn't seem that way outwardly. But when you have an internet bubble that's built around something as like amorphous and sort of illegible as something like curiosity or kindness or things like that, being a nerd, you end up with people who exhibit those characteristics, who come from vastly different backgrounds, who have vastly different political beliefs, and I think it's really, really important in the time that we're living in for that kind of interaction to happen, for that kind of for making the echo chambers ones that are focused on these kind of like deeper values. I think that's the only way we're really gonna fix things in this world.
No, I completely agree. Like, it's just that's what I kind of hate about the online is that it, like, the filter bubble, it's kind of like you are kind of just pushed together via, like, if a recommendation algorithm thinks you have a particular ideology, and now suddenly you have this bubble created around your friendship network, and it's like, well, that's not good. And I kind of, that can see the value of kind of breaking out of that bubble and kind of saying, like, no ideology. What's really important is, like, being kind and being nice to each other and kind of engaging on a more human level. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like illegibility is our ideology. And so that could mean that some people espouse views that like maybe, and I think the Anon thing really helps with that. You have people who just joke about being a certain political like of having certain political beliefs, and then you have people like, and then like 2 days later they'll joke about something else, and I think the algorithm really has a hard time like categorizing those people. So I think that's probably my answer to like how eligibility ties into diversity there, because if the algorithm doesn't know what beliefs to pick up on, then it's kind of like just lump all these people together.
That's so awesome because it's just like, yeah, like I run into that problem a lot on Twitter where The nature of my tweets, like my day, I'll tweet about my day job and then tweet about extremism, then shit post. And the algorithm is like, I don't know what the fuck to do with this guy. Like he's crazy. And then when I became cognizant that like the recommendation algorithm didn't know what to do with me, I think that illegibility was kind of a sort of freedom. Because then it was like, I'm going to use Twitter in 2020 like I used Twitter in 2013, which is, I'm just going to go out, make friends, make mutuals, and see what happens. And that I think like that was really good. That was kind of a net benefit because I don't think if I didn't have that philosophy, I don't think I would have ever kind of found like data science Twitter or weird Twitter or vibe camp. So I think that's pretty cool, like the relationship of kind of illegibility and diversity and kind of how that has actually ended up being a net positive.
Something in there that you said, I apologize for getting a little misleading, but something that in there that you said made me think about one of the things that I did when I got off the street, or like as I was getting off the street, getting closer to there. I started thinking a lot about the ways that I was responsible for the bad things that had happened to me, or the things that were not so great. That was a pretty key component, was getting over this idea that I had been a victim, and like taking responsibility for my actions without reducing the responsibility other people had for theirs. But I started thinking back, like I said, almost a decade living in LA, including the time on the street, which was fairly brief compared to the rest of the time I was there. And I was one of those people who just like, yeah, it's a truth that it is hard to make friends in LA, and I never really questioned it. And I was just going straight from work to home and like complaining about how I only had coworkers for friends. It makes no sense. Like, I wasn't doing any of the things that you would need to do to make friends. So I just kind of like joined Twitter. It was one of the things that I had been thinking about a lot, was just like, I can just make friends anywhere with anybody. Like, if they say no, I'll just try and make a new friend. So I very much went into Twitter with that kind of like mindset. Yeah, it's pretty fun.
That's awesome. So I think we covered a lot today. And as always, even though this is kind of a new format and new type of show for us, I'm still going to ask the legendary last question, which is before we go for the night, give the audience something to think about, something to chew on. It can be anything really. Like we've had guests go on for 20 minutes about something. We've had guests give us a catchphrase or meme. But it is, kind of a parting words or a parting sentiment before retiring for the night.
I guess to carry on the little snippet that I just said, think about the ways that the things you don't like in your life are caused by you. If you can come up with any, I mean, for me, that example was I didn't have any friends, and it took me a while to realize like that was because of me. That was because I wasn't doing things that I needed to do to make friends. But I can think of lots of examples from my life where, and it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to take responsibility for, because a lot of times we've been having these habits our entire lives. I'm starting my life over in my 30s because, and I could like look back on it and feel a lot of like anger and resentment and frustration at myself for not living up to my potential through that whole time. But we could also just reframe it as like, I finally figured my shit out. I could have never figured it out. But I think it's pretty fun once you get over the discomfort to just realize like, I have agency, I have responsibility. I can make things better in my life.
Awesome. Wise words. That was Brooke Bowman, one of the creators of Vibe Camp. We will have a link to Vibe Camp when we publish the show. Thank you for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Of course.